Hi, this is Pastor Chris, and welcome to Strength for Today from Living Hope Baptist Church in Geneva, New York. Today is Monday, May 25th, 2020. I have shared with you before that my first year of college was difficult. I was depressed and lonely, and it was then that I first began to struggle with suicidal ideations. And I think it was in that setting that this little interaction became fixed in my memory. Spring had come to Cincinnati, but it was still cold even with the bright sunshine. The four or five small, sickly trees in front of our dorm had bravely put out some buds, but none of those had opened yet. They seemed to be waiting as if they thought there might be just one more snowstorm or hard frost that lurked over the horizon. I paused in the lobby by the front door and pulled on my coat. The sounds of other students laughing and talking echoed through the cavernous foyer, mingling with the continual music coming from the pole position video game to the left of the door. And it all formed a weird urban half-gas station, half-high school sort of atmosphere. I really hated that place. I stepped out and the door swung shut slowly, causing the sounds of the door to give way to the sounds of the busy street that ran along the front of the building. Delivery trucks, lots of cars, and the odd taxi all racing down the concrete canyon formed by our dorm and by the buildings across the street. Those little trees were doomed, I thought. Their tiny bits of dirt at their bases were black, probably from something to do with all the winter snow plowing that had been going on. I looked up and down the street. At least the litter was thriving, I thought. Green glass from broken beer bottles glinted in the sunshine, and trash from the fast food restaurant across the street blew up and down the street, few pieces trapped in a whirling eddy at the edge of the dorm. Yeah, I thought it was an ugly, lonely place. I turned right and started walking up the sidewalk, assuming my leave-me-alone-and-don't-talk-to-me posture. Head dropped, shoulders slumped, hands in pockets, eyes on the ground. And as I scanned the ground, I noticed that I passed that spot again. That spot was a patch of concrete about 100 feet from the front door of the dorm, if you were looking out from the dorm toward the street. It was close to the bus stop, where you could catch a bus that would take you through an even worse part of the city just before dumping you out downtown. In September, I think it was September of the previous year, when for some reason I needed to take my violin down to the repair shop. The repair shop was located in the heart of downtown, and so that one fall afternoon I had found myself waiting for the bus. I was the only one waiting by that sign, and there was no bus in sight, so I put my violin case down on the ground and sat on it. I have a very strong violin case, and it makes a great seat when you need one. So I sat there and I looked down the street in the direction from which the bus would come. As I looked, I saw three children walking toward me along the sidewalk. Two of them, a boy and a girl, appeared to be in high school. The third, a young girl, was probably, I would guess, in fifth or sixth grade. The older two were talking to one another, not paying attention to the young girl, and she was gradually falling further and further behind them. The two older kids passed me, but the third was still, 30 or so yards away. And as she walked, I studied her a bit. She looked carefree and happy. Her bright clothing stood in stark contrast to the drab street. And as she neared me, I did the same thing I had done with the other two. When they passed, I nodded and gave a sort of half smile, just a habit, sort of way of saying, "Yep, I see you, and hope all is well." Well, as I did that, the little girl stopped walking and stared straight at my face. And then she cussed, flat out swore, and said, "You are ugly." And on she went to join the other two. I was not a believer at that time, so I did not respond kindly. I think I flipped her off and pretended I didn't care. But inside, I was crushed. I had always struggled with self-esteem and self-image, and this was a devastating blow. Some random girl who had never seen me before, who didn't know anything about me, had taken one glance at my face and pronounced me ugly. Funny, now that I'm older and ugly, I don't care. But at the time, I cared a great deal. Not because I cared about what this particular girl thought, but because I assumed that she, with the innocent, cruel honesty of a child, had declared a truth all the world knew, and how somehow had been unwilling to tell me, sort of an emperor's new clothes sort of thing. And for me, the word ugly meant more than mere physical beauty or the lack of it. It meant acceptability, likability, worth. When she said I was ugly, she simply confirmed something I had feared for a long time, that I was worthless and utterly unlovable. In hindsight, it all seems ridiculous, but in my 18-year-old messed up mind, it seemed to make sense and it mattered. And this was the spot, this bit of concrete, this spot where I had been sitting that day, the day I decided to keep my head lowered and my eyes down. And I looked down and I saw that spot and said, yeah, here's that spot. Hey, I heard. It came from across the street. I didn't look because no one would ever call out to me. Hey, hey, it came again. A woman's voice. Over here. I glanced over. Across the street, I saw a young Asian woman beckoning. I looked around me. There was no one else around, so I sort of pointed at my chest and said, me? Yeah, you, she yelled. And then she dodged a car or two and crossed the street. She was dressed in the usual college uniform, jeans, t-shirt, dark jacket, tennis shoes. Hi, she said. How are you doing? Two questions came right to my mind. Do I know this woman? And does she really want to know how I am doing? It took me a minute or two, I think, to process these questions. So she just rattled on with a smile. Has anyone ever talked to you about Mooney marriages? Mooney marriages? I asked. Yes, here, take this, she said. And she handed me a flyer. Read that. It will explain. You're going to be so glad. And it's so nice to meet you, she said. And then she was gone. This was stunning. Another person had actually sought me out and had looked me squarely in the face with no seeming repulsion and had in all seriousness suggested there was a possibility that I, the ugly one, could one day marry. Don't laugh this off. It was powerful. Oh, I had heard about Moonies. We've all heard about the Moonies. I knew they were a wacko cult with bizarre beliefs. But do you know, I almost felt persuaded that day to look into their cult simply because someone from their midst had given me a kind word and had suggested that there might be something in me that was acceptable. Maybe it would be worth, I thought, swallowing something so weird and some ideas that are weirdo stuff to find acceptance and love. Yes, yeah, sometimes our emotional needs are so powerful, they cloud our reason. Well, I resisted the siren call of a Mooney marriage. I think the big turnoff there was that when I found out you didn't get to pick whom you would marry. Let's be honest, unconditional acceptance sounds great when it's coming your way, but not so great when you're supposed to give it. It wasn't worth swallowing nonsense just to get a wife I couldn't stand. And yes, I was that shallow. So on I went in life, finally transferring out of that college in Cincinnati. The next school was better, and I lived in a rental house with three other violinists and our violin teacher. My roommate, the only other guy, was a committed Mormon, and he was really a nice, moral guy. Yeah, sure, I found him a little odd because he wore that strange underwear, and he did something called proxy marriages or something for dead people, but I liked him, and he seemed to accept me. And acceptance is a powerful thing, isn't it? I was still struggling with the I'm ugly and unlovable thing, and so I wasn't sure how to respond when my roommate, we'll call him Steve, asked me if I'd like to go to a dance that day. I don't know what got into me, but I said yes. Usually I'd say no, but this one Friday, I said yes. And so that afternoon, Steve and I drove over to some Mormon church and made our way into a darkened gym where young guys and girls our age were dancing. We had been there just a few moments when a stunningly beautiful girl came over and asked me to dance. We did. And when the song ended, do you know what she did? She stayed by my side, talking to me, like I was the most interesting person in the world. And then there was more dancing, a really beautiful girl. I left that dance hoping to see that girl again, and I said so to Steve. Sure, he said. I get it. Mormon girls are beautiful. Now, I had heard about Mormons before I'd met Steve. I knew about that guy, was it Joseph Smith and his family's crystal ball gazing and his bizarre claims about golden tablets and two huge but undiscovered civilizations in America. Oh, and somewhere in that story was something about funky sunglasses and an angel light called Moron, or Moroni or something. But Steve didn't seem stupid. Maybe there was something to all this Mormonism. "Hey, Steve," I asked, "how'd you become a Mormon?" "Well," he said, "my family, they're not Mormon. I'm the only one. But it kind of started for me this same way, at a dance. I was in high school and I didn't have a lot of friends. But this one guy came along and acted all friendly. And then he invited me to a dance and I went and I had fun. And everybody there was all clean and moral. And I suddenly had a bunch of friends." I said, "I guess I can see why you went to the dance. But what about all that other stuff? You know, the stuff about Joseph Smith and all that." "Well," he said, "I was talking with a Mormon friend one day, and I asked him that very same question. And he showed me a verse from the Book of Mormon that says basically I should pray about it, and if it was true, I'd get a burning in the bosom." Okay, I have to admit, burning in the bosom sounds just weird, and that sounds just as wacko to me today as it did then. I wish at the time I had asked him how to distinguish between that holy burning in your bosom and heartburn, but I didn't. I just wasn't quick enough. I found out later that Mormon girls have to get married. And I found out it seems that it's part of Mormon culture to use girls for proselytizing. Though, of course, they wouldn't say that in those words. And, frankly, they would probably argue against me here, but it's my experience. Anyhow, as I learned more about Mormonism, I was faced with that old quandary. Was I going to allow my emotional needs to override my reason? Loneliness and self-loathing are powerful, and those suffering with them are easy prey for those who are offering comfort, even if the sweets they offer are nothing more than saccharin. As we turn to the Sermon on the Mount, we arrive at Matthew 7:15-20. Here, Jesus gives his followers a warning. He says, "Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravenous wolves." Jesus was warning them and us that there would arise within the church those who would seek to lead others astray. Notice here that they are described as wearing clothing taken from sheep. Yes, it is possible that the picture is one of a wolf wrapping itself with a sheepskin. But it seems more likely to me to suggest that these people are those who have assumed the role of shepherds among the flock, since in that day the shepherd's clothes would be made of wool, and it was the normal attire for the shepherd. If the latter is true, then there may be a subtle hint that these are people who are taking the resources of the sheep for their own benefit. These people, these shepherds or pastors, will be false prophets. A prophet, of course, is one who spoke for God. A true prophet, biblically, is one who proclaims God's infallible word. He speaks as a prophet only if God has spoken to him, and he does not add his own words to what God has said. His prophetic word may include what we call prophecy proper, statements concerning upcoming events, but it also might include much else, exhortations, encouragements, or the like. The distinguishing mark of the true prophet of God is that his words spoken as a prophet are unfailingly true. They never fail. They must not. If they do, he is a false prophet and has lied in speaking for God. But why would someone claim to speak for God when he had not spoken to him? Well, because saying that God has spoken to you is the ultimate appeal to authority. It's the absolute trump card in any argument. It's the triple dog dare of the scriptural and spiritual world. It warns anyone who dares to differ with you that your statement is to challenge God himself. And logically, if you challenge God's statements, you might be incurring his wrath in the future. Well, Jesus says there will be false prophets. Now, I have to ask, how or why would anyone want to be a false prophet? I see only two options here. First, that someone unwittingly becomes a false prophet. And secondly, that someone chooses wittingly to become a false prophet, knowingly. Let's take the first case. Among those who unwittingly become false prophets, there seems to me to be several groups we can identify. First, I think there are those who allow their imaginations to construct within themselves inner dialogues that they conceive erroneously to be discussions with God. And failing to test their thoughts thoroughly against God's revealed word, they then present them to the world as God's messages. Second, I think there are those who fall into theological error through failing in their Bible study to contextualize doctrines within the total analogy of faith. In other words, they just don't check out the entirety of the Bible and compare it to what they are teaching and thinking. These are the ones who conceive some novel interpretation of Scripture and then teach it as God's truth without recognizing or observing the broader context that may negate their view. And thirdly, there are those who frankly hear voices or are mentally unwell. I've met many such people during my stays on mental units. I'm not a psychiatrist, and I do not begin to understand the biological processes that produce psychotic thinking. I just know it happens. And sometimes the sufferers of these maladies misperceive these voices to be God's or his angels. But now let's take a look at the second case. Those who choose intentionally, rationally, to become false prophets. You know, I think it is difficult for good, quote-unquote, average, moral, quote-unquote, people to conceive of the depravity in others, or really to get a grasp of it. I think this is why we have a continuing fascination with psychopaths. Take the example of Jesse Pomeroy, that 14-year-old serial killer from Boston in the 1800s. When captured, indeed, until he died in his 70s, he showed no or little remorse. But what he did show was a mind overflowing with wicked, cunning plans, a mind he used to devise ruses to kidnap, abuse, and kill children for his own pleasure. And normal, quote-unquote, people just cannot conceive of why anyone would do this, even knowing the risks they incur and the damage they do. Or think of a Ted Bundy or Jeffrey Dahmer. These things seem beyond conceiving. Evil exists, though, and there are around us thoroughly bad people who do and will do and knowingly do thoroughly bad things. So why does it strike us as incredible that there would be some who would lie and say that they are false, say they are God's prophets? We find the idea that some might do so especially unbelievable because we, as God-fearers, believe we will answer one day to God for what we have done in the flesh. And the idea that we would have to stand before him and answer him as those who lied about him is odious and terrifying. Bottom line, we just simply ourselves cannot imagine doing such a thing. But Jesus tells us here that some will do so. Wow! So what could possibly motivate someone to engage in such a reckless activity? Well, first, let's consider the possibility of judgment. There seem to me only two options here. First, that this person believes in a coming judgment, but simply doesn't care, doesn't give a rip. Frankly, some people like Jesse Pomeroy, who I spoke of before, seem to show an indifference to coming judgment. But second, there's a possibility this person does not believe in a coming judgment. It is possible that there are some folks who just don't care there is a judgment. These are the, oh, I want to go to hell, that's where all my friends are, I want a party, or maybe the, well, I've done so many bad things already, I don't think it matters if I do more. And they don't take the idea of God seriously, and they don't take the idea of answering to their Creator seriously, and they don't take the idea of a hell seriously. And of course, there are some people out there who just frankly deny God's existence. The Bible calls them fools, but they do exist. And why would somebody then become a false prophet? Well, because frankly, there's money to be made there. The sheep are waiting to be fleeced. Money, greed, ambition, fame, and all the rest is available to those who without conscience set themselves up falsely as God's prophets. So where does that leave us? Well, concluding the obvious, that there are evil people out there who will, wittingly or unwittingly, choose to speak falsely for God. And Jesus says, watch out for them. Now let's take a moment and consider how someone wishing to deceive the church would do so. The answers here seem obvious as well, don't they? These people would cloak themselves in piety, spirituality, and morality. No one in their right mind would follow, at first at least, a pastor who lived in blatant immorality or urged ungodly conduct, would they? So we know that false prophets will arise, probably pastors from within the church. They will appear outwardly moral and godly, but we know Jesus tells us to watch out for them, which leads us to this question: how will we recognize them? Fortunately, Jesus answers that question for us. He answers it this way: you will know them by their fruits. He says that the things they produce through their ministry will reveal that they are false prophets. I think here it is again, important to remind ourselves of the overall theme of the sermon, the kingdom of God, its nature, the nature of its inhabitants, the righteousness it requires, and the strict requirements for entrance. More plainly stated, Jesus talks about his coming kingdom. He talks about what sort of people will go there, and he talks about how you get in through him. So in this context, these false teachers will be anyone who detracts from the focus, Jesus himself. Any teacher who negates or minimizes Jesus' role or the primacy of his kingdom is a false prophet. In a broader context, one who preaches and teaches as truth any unbiblical or untrue doctrine runs the risk of being proved a false prophet. So what is the fruit? I think the fruit here is the body of doctrine or the teaching the prophet delivers. A true prophet, a true shepherd, will proclaim and teach true doctrine. A false prophet will produce false doctrine. But now here is the big question. How can you check a pastor's doctrine? Answer: by comparing itself to the biblical text, God's revealed word. You must be like the Bereans, who were more fear-minded than others. Why? Because they received the preached word with all readiness and searched the scriptures daily to find out whether the things that were being preached to them were really so. Now we need to close, but as we do, go back with me for just a moment to the Moonies and the Mormons. I know who people who struggle calling some such people cultists or lost. They say, oh, but they're my neighbors, and they're such nice people. They're so loving and accepting, and they're so moral. If I judge them by those fruits, surely they're godly or spiritual or something. But the fruit by which you are to know a false prophet is not the outward goodness, love, or morality of his followers. The fruit by which you are to know a false prophet is by the teaching he produces. And if that preaching is bad, if that teaching is bad, if it contradicts the Bible, it is to be condemned and eschewed. Nice or not, the Mormons are wrong. They've been duped by a liar, a false prophet named Joseph Smith. Accepting or not, the Moonies are wrong. They've been duped by Sun Yung Moon, a liar and false prophet. As we close, I encourage you to take Jesus' words to heart. Beware false prophets. Know God's word, study, and know it well, so that you can recognize and distinguish between good and bad fruit. And by the way, I did finally find the peace, love, and acceptance I desperately wanted, but not in a marriage to a Moonie or a Mormon. I found it in a relationship with Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior. And that's why I can say the best is yet to come. God bless.